Hello and welcome to the Pirate Party Australia webcast, dedicated to the discussion of freedom of information and culture, government transparency and civil liberties in the internet age. I'm Sam Kearns and this is episode number 2 for Monday, 30th of April, 2012. One of my goals for this webcast is to get to know the people of Pirate Party Australia, and so I'm going to be doing some pirate profiles where I interview members of the party about how they came to be involved in pirate politics. In the spirit of fairness, I'm going to take a dose of my own medicine and profile myself first. So I'm just going to run through my list of questions that I've got here and give my own answers to them. So the first one is, tell us the short version of where you grew up, your education and careers. Well, I grew up in Midwestern Sydney. I lived in Seven Hills when I was in primary school, and then my family moved out to Kenthurst, where I went to Golston High School. My high school career was a bit of a train wreck. I didn't go to university. I started an associate diploma in electrical engineering at TAFE, but I bombed out of that because I was terrible at maths. Since then, I've worked in, I used to be an Amiga specialist in a computer store, not long after I left school, and then I worked just as a sales assistant in an electronics boutique, and I went into business with a couple of friends of mine, into business as basically, IT service. In the beginning, we were just, selling computers and setting up networks and stuff like that, which pretty quickly segued into us doing web-based programming, and I picked up quite a lot of, web skills. I did that business for 8 years, and, by the end of it, I was, reasonably decent at HTML and CSS and Perl and JavaScript and SQL and those sorts of technologies. I wouldn't say I was great at it. In fact, probably the reason that I left that business is because I was just sort of frustrated at my own inability to effectively pull off larger projects, especially in regards to managing other people to work on large projects. And so eventually, when I got out of that, my dad had recently gotten into doing vending machines, and I went into doing that with him. And so now I'm a owner-operator of drink and snack vending machines all over the north side of Sydney. During that time, I lived in various places in northwest Sydney, eventually ending up in Hornsby, where I lived for quite a while from 2003 till 2009. And now I live on the Central Coast. Next question is, how long have you been interested in technology? I was pretty lucky growing up. My parents were, reasonably well off. And, I had Game and Watches and Atari 2600. And then when I was about 8 years old or so, my parents bought the family a Commodore 64. And that was it. I was gone. The C64 actually came with like a 4-part magazine series on how to program the Commodore 64 in BASIC, and I devoured that, and played lots of C64 games and what have you. And then in middle high school, I sold the C64 and got an Amiga 500, and it probably wasn't until, I think it was 1997, pretty much, not until I went into business with my friends in the, the IT, initially the IT service business, that I actually had my first PC, and that was like Windows 98. And Yeah, so I've, you know, been a computer nut all my life, really. And I used to be a hardcore gamer, but since I've had children, I'm not anymore. Next question is, when did you become active on social issues? This is only really a recent thing for me. I think I definitely fit the supposed profile of a middle child, is that they're more keenly aware of social issues, and I think that is me. I've always had a bent towards this sort of thing, but I think it's really taken until, you know, my middle years now before I've really had the confidence and the knowledge to, you know, feel like I had a solid opinion on things that was worth defending. Unlike someone like, say, Brendan Malloy, who knows exactly what he's talking about and is, you know, unashamed to say it, and he's only like, I don't know, 20, early 20 somethings. I know when I was his age, I was a complete waste of space, and the stuff I talked about was complete bullshit. Next question, how did you first hear about the Pirate Party? Well, this is sort of there's a bit of a roundabout journey here, because I'm a hobbyist musician. I play synthesizer, and all the music on the webcast was written by me as an example of my work. I sort of took a, you know, in my early 20s, I sort of stopped playing for a while, and it wasn't until my early 30s I decided to take up the keyboard again with a vengeance. And at that time I was checking out a lot of blogs about about synth technology and music production and the music business and stuff like that. And it was from reading blogs like Synthtopia and Create Digital Music that I got linked over to Hypebot, which is a new music industry blog. And they frequently link to Tech Dirt. And then, so I've been reading Tech Dirt for probably about 2 years now, and that's really where, you know, my biggest source of you know, my biggest exposure to pirate politics has been. Even though I didn't realize it, because I know he didn't used to talk a lot about Pirate Party, but you know, there would be the occasional link to Rick Folkfinger. And then eventually I sort of slowly learned more and more about this pirate movement and this guy called Rick Folkfinger, and I started reading his blog, and I just love it. I love everything he's got to say. I think he's awesome. He's my new hero, et cetera, et cetera. And so I've been following his blog for about a year now, and then only just recently, because I only joined the Pirate Party in January of this year, and it was, you know, probably like December of last year that I was looking around for news on NBN and you know, Australian technology issues, and I came across the Delimiter website, delimiter.com.au, and started reading that, and they frequently link the Pirate Party Australia's press releases. So, and from there, once I started reading those, I thought, oh, local Pirate Party. Now, I'd never even thought about that. So I went over and checked it out, and I saw that they had free membership, and I thought, why not? Final question, how have you been involved with the party since you joined? Well, for the first 2 months, I really wasn't involved at all. I sent in my application, and I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks, and then I heard back and Brendan sent me an email saying, hey, got your application, it's all good. And I signed up to the mailing list, and there's basically no traffic on the email list, which is usually the way that I operate with, you know, keeping in touch with online communities. I'm a mailing list kind of guy. And then after it was like late February or early March, I was thinking, because I got involved in the party because I wanted to find out what was happening locally and sort of, you know, get involved in discussion and about pirate issues in Australia. And I was sort of, you know, feeling quite disconnected and like I hadn't achieved that. So I thought, right, I've got to go and find out where everyone is. And so it didn't take me long to find everyone on IRC. And then once I was on IRC, I was quite enjoying that for a couple of weeks. And it was, you know, didn't take me very long to decide that something that I could do for Pirate Party is to do a webcast. Because I've actually wanted to do a webcast of my own for like a year or so or more now, because I'm a voracious devourer of podcasts. I listen to about 30 hours of podcasts every week, and have done for several years now. And I've got all the tools for audio production, but I've just never really had, something to say or an audience to say it to. And I thought, well, a Pirate Party webcast would really be a good way for me to get to know everyone. And so that's why I'm here. And so the final question, what do you think is a realistic outcome for the pirate movement in Australia over the next 5 years? Well, I don't really know. I mean, this is the first time I've been involved in any kind of political party. So given that, you know, the Green Movement, which has, you know, a really high profile nationally, is well known. I mean, they've been around for 30 years and they've got like a handful of people in elected office. And it's really only just now after 30 years that they're really becoming like the third force in Australian politics. So I don't have like big expectations of, you know, multiple seats in Parliament within 5 years or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that we can't affect things, because, I think even just getting some votes or getting some notoriety, even if we don't actually get someone elected or anything like that, I think it's still going to make politicians think about pirate issues and you know, how they can appeal to that demographic. Probably what I'd really like to see is that I believe next year in 2013, there's another expiry deadlines of copyright coming up that is going to have industry lobbying hard for yet another extension. And I think it would be really great to see the pirate perspective starting to come into the discussion, rather than it just being the lobbyists going, we need an extension, and the government just goes, yep, all right, and there's no other discussion. I'd really like to see, I think in the next 5 years, a realistic goal is that we see just the idea of pirate politics starting to filter into the discussion and you know, really starting to have an impact on the way that the government thinks about these issues. And that's going to wrap up the Pirate Profile for this webcast. We'll look forward to some other voices in future. So if you're a pirate and you're listening to this, be afraid. Be very afraid. Next up on the Pirate Party Australia webcast, we have a very short snippet that I recorded at the recent pirate meetup in Sydney on April 28th. I intended to record more and really wish that I had, but I was feeling a bit timid because this is the first time I had met everyone in person, and I would have needed to herd everyone to a quieter venue if I was going to get any serious recording done. All I can say is that I promise to be more pushy next time. After the official meeting location, a few of us pushed on into the night and into a really cool pirate-themed bar. And for those of you who didn't come, you definitely missed out, because this was a really cool place with some very nice rum, which you'll hear us commenting on at the end of this segment.
It was funny because I was wearing a suit with a white t-shirt, so I didn't have a proper undershirt. So I'm like, smart business. No, dumb business. Smart casual.
Dumb business.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what I really like? It's one of those things I watched and it just, like, it struck me. I was watching Rick Boakley, like, a couple of months ago, he posted a tweet or something saying, I have awesome
Patriots or something.
Yeah.
There was a speech by a guy in the German parliament.
Yeah.
And he got up and he made this a speech to the parliament. And so, you know, it shows him, he's at the podium and he's talking, and then it sort of pans around and shows the pirates sitting in their block.
Yeah. In just t-shirts.
And they're all there just looking like IT workers with their laptops in front of them. And like everyone else is like all stuffy old grey hair with like really expensive suits. And then the pirate party are there in like jeans and t-shirts. They've all got their laptops open. You know, they're all like, you know, I'm logging this, you know. And I just thought, you know, but you just look at that and you think, you know that something's going right when you look in the parliament and you see people you identify with.
Yeah.
You know, when you look in the parliament and you don't recognise any of the people there, you know, there's something wrong with that. And it doesn't even occur to you until you actually see it and you go, there's my people.
Yes.
You know, and I really had that moment. I was watching that video and I just went, yeah, there's something really
the
right.
Likelihood
something
of ever really having right that moment in Australian politics, almost zero. But that's why we aren't just like the other traditional parties in Australia that sit there and go, we gun for money and then we gun for votes. No, we gun for annoying everyone with our logic, then we gun for votes, and then we gun for money after that. We're us back where we are. Make change, get elected. Not get elected and make change.
So what do you think about this idea of that was being discussed on IRC the other day of going for like local government? Like,
yeah, no, I'm fine with that, but we have to be registered in the state to run for it.
But just thinking more, you know, is it useful?
Sorry?
Is it useful?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On not so much copyright, but on our transparency and on our general technology bias. Because we can promote, you know, community Wi-Fi and general technological things like, why have parking meters when we can have them all connected wirelessly and fire the business you want? Stuff like that. Actually making positive change for positive reasons. Well, that drink was
nice. That is so smooth.
It was $9.
It's nice.
Yes, it is. This is the third one I've had with vanilla in it. It's the best one so far.
And the other voice in that segment was Brendan Malloy, our illustrious party secretary and general dog's body. The final segment of the webcast is another installment of Rick Folkfinger's essay, The History of Copyright. When we last left our heroes, it was 1643, and control of the copyright monopoly had just been wrested from the crown by the British Parliament. Fast forwarding a bit, there was something called the Glorious Revolution in 1688, and Parliament's composition changed radically to mostly people who had previously been at the business end of censorship and weren't all too keen for that to continue. Therefore, the stationer's monopoly was made to expire in 1695. So from 1695 onward, there was no copyright. None. Creativity soared again, and historians claim that many of the documents that eventually led to the founding of the United States of America were written in this time. Unfortunately, the London Company of Stationers were not happy at all with the new order, where they had lost their lucrative monopoly. They gathered their families on the stairs of Parliament and begged for the monopoly to be reinstated. It is noteworthy that authors did not ask for the copyright monopoly. The printers and distributors did. There was never an argument along the lines that nothing would be written without copyright. The argument was that nothing would be printed without copyright. This is something else entirely. Parliament, having just abolished censorship, was keen on not reinstituting a central point of control with a possible abuse potential. The stationers responded by suggesting that writers should own their works. In doing so, they killed three birds with one stone. One, Parliament would be assured that there was no central point of control which could be used to censor. Two, the publishers would retain a monopoly for all intents and purposes, as the writers would have nobody to sell their works to but the publishing industry. Three, and perhaps most importantly, the monopoly would be legally classified as Anglo-Saxon common law rather than the weaker case law, and therefore given much stronger legal protection. The publishing lobby got as they wanted, and the new copyright monopoly was reenacted in 1709, taking effect on April 10th, 1710. This was the copyright lobby's first major victory. What we see at this point in history is copyright in its unspun form, a monopoly with heritage from censorship where artists and authors were not even considered, but where it was always for the publisher's profit. Also, the stationers would continue to impound, destroy, and burn others' printing presses for a long time, despite not having the right any longer. Abuse of power came immediately and would last until the pivotal Entick versus Carrington case in 1765, when yet another of these raids for unlicensed, read unwanted, authors had taken place. In the verdict of this court case in 1765, it was firmly established that no right may be denied to any citizen if not expressly forbidden by law, and that no authority may take itself any right not explicitly given by law. Thus, the very first foundations of modern democracy and civil liberties were won in the battle against the copyright monopoly. There is nothing new under the sun. When the United States was founded, the concept of monopolies on ideas was carried to the New World and debated intensely. Thomas Jefferson was a fierce opponent to the monster of monopolies on ideas. A compromise was reached. Copyright didn't originate in the United States, as we have seen. The idea had been there beforehand, and the Founding Fathers carried the laws with them into their new country. The topic of monopolies on ideas, however, was a topic not easily settled. Jefferson wrote, "If nature has made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess as long as he keeps it to himself. But the moment it is divulged, it forces itself into the possession of everyone, and the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. Its peculiar character, too, is that no one possesses the less because every other possesses the whole of it. He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. That idea should freely spread from one to another over the globe for the moral and mutual instruction of man and improvement of his condition seems to have been peculiarly and benevolently designed by nature when she made them, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation." In the end, the United States Constitution was the first one to specify the reason for copyrights and patents to be granted. It is very clear and straightforward in its justification for the existence of copyright in United States law, to promote the progress of the sciences and useful arts. It is particularly notable that the purpose of the monopoly was not for any profession to make money, neither writer nor printer nor distributor. Instead, the purpose is exemplary in its clarity. The only justification for the monopoly is if it maximizes the culture and knowledge available to society. Thus, copyright, in the US, and therefore predominantly today, is a balance between the public's access to culture and the same public's interest of having new culture created. This is tremendously important. In particular, note here that the public is the only legitimate stakeholder in the wording and evolution of copyright law. The monopoly holders, while certainly being benefactors of the monopoly, are not legitimate stakeholders and should have no say in its wording, just like a regiment town should have no say in whether that regiment is actually needed for national security. It is useful to point at the wording of the US Constitution when people falsely believe that the copyright monopoly exists so that artists can make money. It never did, not in any country. Meanwhile, in the United Kingdom. In the meantime, in the United Kingdom, books were still quite expensive, mostly because of the copyright monopoly. Book collections were only seen in rich men's homes, and some started benevolently to lend books to the common people. The publishers went mad about this and lobbied Parliament to outlaw the reading of a book without first paying for their own copy. They tried to outlaw the public library before the library had even been invented. Reading without paying first? That's stealing from the authors, taking the bread right out of their children's mouths. But Parliament took a different stance, seeing the positive impact of reading on society. The problem perceived by Parliament was not the self-described eternal plight of the copyright monopolists, but the problem that rich men in society dictated who would read and who wouldn't. It seemed beneficial to society to level the playing field, to create public libraries accessible to poor and rich alike. The copyright monopolists went absolutely ballistic when they heard about this idea. "You can't let anybody read any book for free. Not a single book will ever be sold ever again. Nobody will be able to live off their writing. No author will write a single book ever again if you pass this law. Parliament in the 1800s was much wiser than today, however, and saw the copyright monopolist's tantrum for what it was. Parliament took a strong stance that public access to knowledge and culture had a larger benefit to society than the copyright monopoly, and so in 1849, the law instituting public libraries in the UK was passed. The first public library opened in 1850. And as we know, not a single book has been written ever since. Either that, or the copyright monopolist's rant about nothing being created without a strong monopoly was as false then as it is when repeated today. Note, in some European countries, authors and translators get some pennies for every book lent from a library. It should be strongly noted that this is not a compensation for an imaginary loss of income, as if every reduction in the monopoly required compensation, but a national cultural grant which happens to measure popularity and therefore suitability for that grant using statistics from libraries. Besides, the grant appeared in the early 1900s, long after libraries. Meanwhile, in Germany. Germany had no copyright monopoly during this time. Several historians argue that this led to the rapid proliferation of knowledge that enabled Germany to take the industrial lead over the United Kingdom. Knowledge could be spread cheaply and efficiently. So in a way, Germany's leapfrogging of the United Kingdom proved British Parliament right. The national interest of access to culture and knowledge does supersede the monopoly interest of the publishers. In the late 1800s, the publisher's ever-strengthening copyright monopoly had lopsided the creator's chances of making any revenue off of their works. Basically, all the money went to publishers and distributors, and creators were left starving due to the copyright monopoly, just like today. A person in France named Victor Hugo would take the initiative to try to level the playing field by internationalizing a French tradition known as droit d'auteur, writer's right, into the copyright monopoly. Also, he would try to make the copyright monopoly international. Until now, it had just been a national monopoly. A French writer could sell his monopoly to a French publisher, and the publisher would enjoy monopoly powers in France, but not in Germany or the United Kingdom. Hugo sought to change this. Paradoxically, the copyright and patent monopolies were forgotten when free market laws were enacted across Europe in the mid-1800s. Patent law still talks about prevention of disloyal competition as justification for its existence, which is a remnant from when guilds dictated products, craftsmen, and prices. If a business practices loyal competition in their industry segment today, we raid them at dawn and haul their ass to court. The copyright monopoly is a similar remnant from the Printing Guild of London. Victor Hugo would try to balance the immense powers of the publishers by giving creators some rights under the copyright monopoly as well, unfortunately impoverishing the public further. It is important here to remember that there are three parties to the copyright conflict: creators, publishers, and the public. Ironically, the public is the only legitimate stakeholder in the monopoly's design. While Hugo didn't live to see the fruition of his initiative, the Berne Convention was signed in 1886. It said that countries should respect the copyrights of other countries, and an agency, BIRPI, was set up as watchdog. This agency has mutated, grown, and swelled, and is today WIPO, which still oversees the Berne Convention, which has also swelled, mutated, and been hijacked twice. More on this shortly. So at this point, there are four aspects of the copyright monopoly which have more differences between them than similarities. 1. The commercial monopoly to fixations of a work. This is the original monopoly granted to London's Printing Guild in exchange for censorship. 2. The commercial monopoly to performances of a work. If somebody performs a work publicly on a for-profit stage, the monopoly holder has a right to demand money. 3. The droit moral to be acknowledged as creator. The right for an author or artist to be acknowledged as creator of his or her work, acting as protection against counterfeiting and against plagiarism. 4. The droit moral to veto an improper performance of the work. If an artist feels that a performance slights the work or name of the artist, they have the right to deny that performance the light of day. The droids' morals are very different in nature from the commercial monopolies in that they cannot be sold or transferred. This sets them sharply apart from the justification that convinced British Parliament to reenact the copyright monopoly in 1709. It is also noteworthy how often these four aspects are deliberately confused to defend the most controversial and damaging of the monopolies, the commercial monopoly on fixations, and later duplication. You will often hear people from the copyright industry defending the monopoly by asking, "Would you want somebody else to take your work and claim it was theirs?" However, this is the quite uncontroversial third part, the droit moral of attribution and credit, which cannot honestly be used to defend any of the two commercial monopolies. The United States didn't like moral rights, by the way, so they stayed outside of the Berne Convention until they could use it for leverage against Toyota 100 years later. We'll return to that soon. And that brings us to the end of another webcast. Our quote this week comes from our man Rick Folkfinger. In the 21st century, the internet is speech, is assembly, is association, and is the press. If a corporation can't sustain a business without having these rights limited, then that corporation deserves to go out of business. The sooner the better. The Pirate Party Australia webcast, including all music, is written, recorded and produced by Sam Kearns for Pirate Party Australia and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 Unported license. Thanks for listening.